Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, IBC Bank, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.
McKinnon and Mike Basilis. So, Mike, let me start with you, because closer to home is where we should start. So the premise I put forth at the beginning, I think I want to ask you about. You're the great pollster. Did you see 22 pickups in the House for the Republicans?
No.
Not even the great Basilis saw 22.
Mm-mm.
What was your best guess going into this?
12.
12? That was the most optimistic and the most outside prediction.
Well, it's one of those things where you almost have to count everything that's out there and say, well, we're going to, the Republicans win this seat, they'll win this seat, and just keep going down the list. As it was, Republicans took back 14 of the 17 seats that they had lost in one of the last three election cycles, and then five more.
And the high watermark for Speaker Craddock was, and for the Republicans previous, was 88. And so we are now at 99.
So can I ask a follow-up to Mike on that? So I call Mike, I call him Dr. Mop, which means in polling vernacular, there's an expression called margin of error. I call him margin of perfection because he's so good. He's literally the best pollster in the country, I think. So it's interesting that you say that, but what I'm curious about is that polling, generally speaking, is it's all about modeling, and you model on certain premises, and the premises are you look at historical turnout, right? So you're modeling on what would be a generally off-year turnout. So is the turnout overall just more than expected, and that's where the
That's a great question. Was this simply more people turned out to vote for more Republicans, and as a result of that, more Republicans won?
There's two parts to that. There is the turnout overall. And 4.9 million people voting is not that unexpected. We thought that the turnout from 2002 to 2006 would increase. And it went down a little. It went down about 200,000 votes. Then it spiked back up. The campaign had planned for 5.16 million. Always nice to plan for a little bit more.
So you planned for 5.16 million this time, and in fact, the turnout was lower.
Well, because if you plan a little higher, you set all your goals a little higher, and
you're
not dejected if you come in a little short of those. You're still a winner. So being around 5 million is not that unusual. What was unusual was the disproportionate number of Republicans that turned out relative to Democrats. And that's when you get into modeling and you start looking at different levels of turnout. And as turnout decreases, typically, the same thing happened in California where we were working on some propositions, you would see the percentage of Republicans increase and the percentage of Democrats decrease. Now it's a matter of picking what level of turnout. And we typically, in the Perry campaign, and did the same thing for Dewhurst and Abbott, would look at the 83% of our samples that were most likely to vote. And that takes the state from being about a 7 to 8 point Republican advantage to a 12 point Republican advantage. You have to go down to this, about the 75% of the voters in my model that are the most likely to vote to get to a percentage of Republicans to Democrats, as disproportionate as it was, that could accurately predict the governor's race, and still be point short.
But your final poll, and just to come to Mark, I want to ask the same question about predictions on the national scale. Your final poll for the governor's race, your internal compass of where this was going to end up was what before the election?
We had him at 52.5. I did.
Yeah. And White at?
White at 45.
So you actually were thinking it was going to be high single digits.
High single digits. If you had to go down to, again, the 75% turnout to get Perry up to 54.4 and drop White down about another 2 points. But the same turnout model, we were focusing on the governor's race because that had all the interest. The same turnout model that I used to predict Perry, I was 0.5 of a point, a half a point high on Abbott. I said he was going to get 64.7.
Well, I think it was that Dallas Morning News endorsement of Radnofsky that probably did it.
Yeah. We've learned previously that, particularly in the Republican primary, that endorsements from the newspapers make voters less likely to vote.
I am kidding, of course. Mark, what
strategy?
What crystal ball did you have that told you 60 was going to be the number of pickups in the U.S. House for the Republicans?
Oh, it was really just a wild guess, really. I made the assumption that it was going to be a wave, that Republican enthusiasm would be up considerably, and that if that happened, that it was going to be pretty big. And I think that it was reflected in, picking up states like Toomey in Pennsylvania, for example. I mean, that's, I remember in the last couple presidential elections, we always target Pennsylvania thinking we can get it, and it's always like this date that turns you down.
Well, and in fact, Toomey himself has been found wanting by these very same voters before.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so that's an indication of, you know, just a, sort of a bellwether of what happened around the country, particularly in the Midwest and really key areas. But, you know, it just, it there was an enthusiasm gap. Republicans were up, Democrats were down, and by the way, it's the biggest turnover since World War II.
It is significantly bigger than 94.
Yeah.
In terms of pickup, right?
Yeah.
Did the Republicans win, or did Obama and the Democrats lose?
Oh, I think it was more referendum on the Democrats. I mean, I think the thing the Republicans really have to be wary of, that this was not a endorsement of the Republicans.
Well, in fact, there was a poll going into yesterday that showed that the unfavorable ratings of these two parties were equal at 53%.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not as if there was this overwhelming support for the Republicans and that the Democrats lost because of that. It was more, we just don't like the Democrats.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of dancing in the end zone. I'm glad to see the leadership of the Republican Party is being pretty sober about their, you know, their body language last night, and their speeches were all pretty understated, which I think is the right approach.
But again, to get to 60 in the U.S. House, or to get to 22, especially in the Texas House, you had to go through some races that probably most people thought, even in a tsunami, right? I mean, people who were not even on lists suddenly had to be on lists. And for a while there last night, at least, Mark, to stay with you for a second, on the U.S. House side, there were people who, for most of the night, were down, and people thought, how is John Dingell down?
Yeah.
Right? How is this person down? How is that? I mean, for a long time, people thought this could be significantly more than 60.
Yeah, well, people like Barney Frank were on the boat.
Right.
You know, so, but then you look at races like Chet Edwards. I mean, that's a significant loss for the Democrats. I mean, if you can't...
Could he have won that seat under any circumstances?
No, he couldn't. I mean, you couldn't be more of a centrist Democrat than Chet Edwards, right?
Well, you know, from the standpoint of Republicans, they pick out of the several hundred votes every year where they might have been more liberal than they needed to be for the district. But it could never turn it into a situation in which Republicans could capitalize on his votes in his years in Congress. It took this wave to sweep him away.
Yeah, I mean, he should have been knocked off many cycles.
Well, we always say, you know, the Chet Edwards, who represents the most Republican district in the country represented by a Democrat, and they'd attempted to get it many times. The dog finally caught the car, as far as this goes this time, right, after all those years?
Yeah.
Now, do you think that in the case of the Texas races, that this was a case of the Republicans winning, or that the governor successfully nationalized the election to the point that the outcome was as much a reaction to the Democrats as it was at the national level?
Oh, that's something that has to be looked at, and see how many candidates for governor in the different states did what Perry did. Perry did a good job making this a referendum against big government.
Well, but I'm talking about specifically here. The nationalization of the election was, in fact, the reason.
But we saw that in a lot of states.
Yeah.
And a lot of our candidates would work with us on the polling to come up with different ways to talk about how the Democrat incumbent was doing things similar to Obama style. And you saw a lot of those ads. You saw a lot of ads with, guess what, Obama's picture on it and the Democrat.
In local races where, frankly, Obama doesn't have much of a hand. It seemed as if in many of these races that no matter who the Republican House candidate was running against or where he or she was running, the opponent was Obama, not so much the person that was being run.
And in some ways it was representation of just big government, big intrusive government. It could be government that spends too much, government that regulates too much. Republicans were using that feeling and that feeling of anger that was out there. You know, one of the things that we saw back in 2006 was that on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 being no interest at all in the election and 10 being extremely interested in that election, 48% of Democrats were at a 10, but only 40% of Republicans were at a 10. Fast forward to this election, just last week, 48% of Democrats were at a 10, but 59% of Republicans were at a 10. And we asked the question about whether or not people shared the views of the Tea Party movement. And those that shared all the views of the Tea Party movement, 83% of them were at a 10. So there was, those people were out in force making a statement.
Now, I want to come back to the Tea Party in a second, but I want to stay on this notion of the Democrats losing. Was there anything that the Democrats could have done in Texas this year to make this less of a bloodbath than it was?
Well,
from what you saw in your polling?
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the fact that they have one candidate running statewide with resources, to again, you know, in Bill White, it's difficult. One of the things Republicans had is a statewide number of candidates that could communicate a message, communicate what they're about, and even though they didn't have to do much, Dewhurst and Abbott were part of that. And when you're down ballot candidates and there's no umbrella, there's no air cover from other races to help you, you're on your own. And so a lot of these Democrats were really on their own fighting against this attitude out there that Obama hasn't done what we thought he was going to do, and it's we're going to send a message.
Is your perception, speaking of White specifically, that there was anything White could have done? You know, Dave Carty and I were talking before this. He was correct to say that the press asserted without any evidence beforehand or after the fact that the Hutchison-Perry race was competitive in the primary. And the press asserted effectively without evidence beforehand or after the fact that the White-Perry race was competitive, when in fact it seems as if, in retrospect, neither race was actually ever competitive.
Well, there were points in which maybe the races were seen as more competitive. In the Perry-White race here in the fall, we saw Perry's lead increase a point each week from late September. And that's the point at which Dave Carney and I were talking about this last night, in which the campaign was able to get on television at a complete 1,000 gross rating point buy per week and stay on. Before that, the Perry campaign didn't have the resources, because of the primary that was so expensive, to be on TV earlier. You may remember in 2002, the Perry campaign was on in August. We had to go another 5 weeks or so before we could get on at that same level.
Was there ever a poll that you had internally that showed this race close? I mean, leave aside the independent polls.
When we came out of the primary, it was closer.
Right, but at any point in the real meat of the general election, did you have any polls that made you think, maybe this is actually a close race?
Yeah, that went through late summer. We gaining a point per week from late September, we had about a 4 or 5 point lead, and we just kept adding.
You know, I mean, it's got to be discouraging for Democrats here when, you know, when you look at the race that White ran, it was a pretty good race. I mean, he raised significant.
You think it was?
Yeah, I do. I mean, he convinced the Democratic establishment that he could win this race, and that's saying a lot. And he had to do a lot of things in order to convince them that was the case. And
right. And well, on the other hand, Mark, honestly, I don't mean it had to seem like an unfair question. Would Tom Schieffer have done worse than White in the end?
Would he have done worse?
No. Would Tom Schieffer have gotten fewer votes than White in the end?
No. No, I think he would have gotten more.
You think Tom Schieffer would have gotten more?
Yeah, I do.
I'd like to hear you explain that.
I think that Schieffer would have attracted more conservative voters, more independent voters than White did. I mean, he's got a track record as being a conservative. He's appointed by Bush as ambassador. Not much. Yeah. A point or two, but not much.
Right, but not much. Same question I asked Mike. Let me ask you: could the Democrats at the national level have done anything differently to make this outcome different, or was it baked into the cake already?
Barring changing the policies that got them where they were, and you know, talk of more stimulus was a you know, put them into a death spiral. I think fundamentally the closing message of the Obama administration, the Democrats, was deeply flawed. I thought this whole
talk about that.
The foreign money argument was first of all, it was bogus. Second of all, it was hypocritical. This coming from a president who had pledged to campaign for president under the caps, and then broke the pledge because he made a judgment that he could raise a lot more money and. By busting the caps, although he had pledged not to do so, and $400 million of that money was untraceable. So it was a bogus argument, it was a hypocritical argument, it was a process argument.
He's arguing an inside baseball argument to a mass audience.
Yeah, and it was. Right. I was really surprised by that. So that didn't help.
You know the old Bum Phillips line? I don't know, I think it's attributed to Bum Phillips. I think it's actually about Bum Phillips, that he can take his guys and beat your guys, and then he can take your guys and beat his guys. Could you have taken his guys and beat your guys in this case at the national level? Could you have taken Obama and the Democrats and done something differently yourself with them?
This election was a lot like 08. There's nothing that Democrats could have really done fundamentally to change the outcome.
The same way that the Republicans couldn't
have done anything. McCain could have run a perfect campaign. He would have lost by 4 instead of 5.
Still wouldn't have mattered.
Yeah.
How about in your perspective? Do you think that could you have taken their guys and beat your guys?
You know, it's been real difficult. You said something a moment ago, and it made me think about the governor of West Virginia who won the Senate seat. And he tried to do his best to distance himself from Obama. Even though he had some policies in his state, his own little cap and trade bill that he signed into law, he was hammering Obama. Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't go that path. I'm not for the health care that I said I was for a year and a half ago that was signed into law. He did everything he could, as smart as he could, to distance himself from Obama. And I don't think a number of these Democrats did enough to remove them and push Obama away.
But in point of fact, could people at the local level, I mean, I understand at the national level, people could have run away from Obama, could have run away from Pelosi, could have run away from Reid to some degree, but honestly, could Jim McReynolds have beaten James White by running away from Obama?
No. He has a problem with a lot of these state rep races, is getting any kind of a message out that is at a high decibel level where people are hearing it soundly enough. And if he brings up Obama, and then people get into wonder.
Right. Even in a negative,
Obama,
they're
connected.
Yeah.
And West Virginia, citywide race is like a local race.
That was a great ad that Manchin did.
Well, and Manchin was one of the only bright spots, as it turned out, for the Democrats. I mean, maybe Manchin should be majority leader of the Senate now, actually. Just, you know. Mike referenced the Tea Party. Obviously, this was a year in which the Tea Party was an enormous source of momentum and energy. Nationally, a number of Tea Party candidates did lose. Sharon Engel lost. The Witch lost. But a number of Tea Party candidates won. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Tea Party is clearly going to be a force in American politics going forward, at least for the next couple of years. Talk about that from a national perspective. What does that mean for the Republicans? What does it mean for the country?
Well, there's going to be a fascinating struggle on both sides of the aisle. There's no question, watching Jim DeMint last night and watching Rand Paul, that they've got big designs for a Tea Party caucus, and that they're going to really push their agenda. And I think there's going to be some significant ripples as a result of the Tea Party influence on the Republican Party. There's going to be a struggle for the heart and soul in the direction, and we're going to be immediately into a presidential contest.
I mean, the presidential contest begins today.
It begins today.
Right.
And so, I think it's going to be, they lost a few races, but I think that there's, with Marco Rubio, by the way, Marco Rubio gave one of the best speeches I've ever seen last night. It was fantastic. And this guy truly is, although he's, you know, sort of branded a Tea Party candidate, I think he's I think he's the face of the Republican Party of the future. And I think he's got great potential. But the Tea Party's going to have a lot of SWAT with the Republican caucus. But there's going to be, you know, the establishment Republicans aren't going to want to turn over everything.
Well, that's
guys.
My question. So the Tea Party's going to have a lot of SWAT with the Republican caucus. Are the Republicans going to have a lot of SWAT with the Tea Party? Who's the horse and who's the cart in this calculation?
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch, and it's unclear, but...
I mean, is it potentially an opportunity for the Democrats? I mean, could the difficulty of integrating the mainstream Republicans
sure
in the Tea Party?
Sure it is. I mean, the Democrats will try and say that the Republican Party's been taken over by Jim DeMint.
Right.
And Jim DeMint's going to give them a lot of ammo to do that. I mean, he's clearly asserting himself, and that's the guy to watch in the next few months.
But you noticed that the first thing that happened last night was they called a race for Ron Paul, and the second thing that happened was that Senator Cornyn made up with Rand Paul.
Sure.
Right? I mean, they said, you know, we were thrilled to have him, Senator-elect Paul, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's obvious that the Republican Party that was not for the Tea Party candidates is now getting comfortable with the idea that these guys are our guys now.
Yeah, but at the same time, it was clear watching Rand Paul's speech that he's not going to just roll over and become an establishment Republican.
Right.
I mean, he's got designs on a Tea Party caucus.
Now, at the state level, this problem of integration didn't seem quite so much the case. I mean, there were a couple of races in which, you know, David Simpson knocked off Tommy Merritt or... Van Taylor knocked off Mabry Jackson. There were a few cases in which, quote, Tea Party candidates knocked off, quote, establishment Republicans. But the fact is, it's one big happy family at this point, right?
And a lot of these candidates, it's more of a belief. It's what they believe in. It's they're against big government, and they just want to make a statement. And there are candidates that got involved in this election that are just normal people that just wanted to do something. Jason Isaac was one of those people. He agrees.
In a million years, going back to the beginning of this cycle, in a million years did you think Patrick Rose was vulnerable?
Well, let me tell you what happened there. Jason came to me about this time last year, maybe a month or two before, and he wanted to run. He wanted to run for Congress. And I said, this district you're looking at is not very easy to win for a Republican.
Whose district? That would have been
Floyd Doggett.
It would have been Doggett's district, yeah.
And but he was one of those people that just wanted to help. And I knew him from my son's lacrosse league. He was his coach, and I was his assistant. And we're having this conversation in my office, and he wants to do something, and he could just see it. He's just like a lot of people that are just fed up. And I said, well, where do you live? And he said, Dripping Springs. Well, let me tell you about 1994.
And a light bulb goes over the head of Dr. Mop.
And I said, 1994 was a year in which there were people that were down by 25 points, like Mike Galloway to Carl Parker, 2 months before the election, had a mouthpiece or two, and they won. I said, this is the type of election where if you can, you know, doesn't hurt your business, doesn't hurt your marriage and your family set up, this might be one you want to get involved in. Jason Isaac was the candidate of the year. That guy worked so hard. He was almost every night of the week, he's out walking, every weekend. I had Representative Phil King said, he's candidate of the year. They went to an event, there was people standing outside the barbecue shack door. But he's just one person of many that decided they wanted to get out and do something. And, well, yeah, he may share a lot of the views of the Tea Party movement because there's people out there that are just had enough. And he wanted to do something. He didn't know what else to do. He just, you know, shaking in the chair, I got to do something. Okay, run for office.
But to this notion of where the Tea Party Republicans and the establishment Republicans in Texas come together or don't, in fact, Speaker Strauss last night at midnight released a list, and we all know pledges are not worth the paper they're written on, but released a list of 122 members of the House who are committed to returning him to the Speaker's office. And on that list are many people who you would have thought are, quote, Tea Party or Tea Party staff members who you thought might have been willing to go with another candidate. So there does seem to be this integration already happening where everyone's rallying behind.
And I think what you're going to see is that people are ready to get to work, do the business of the state. Revenues aren't matching previous expenses, and so they're going to make that work out.
What is your?
Which I think by, you know, is a great example. We've got a tradition here in Texas of showing how government can work. Rick Perry's done a great job of showing the difference between what's happened between California and Texas in the last few years. I think Speaker Strauss is exactly the kind of model for bipartisan leadership that we used to have here in Texas, and that the nation needs to look to, and I think will increasingly look to as they look at the Texas success story.
Well, let me ask you what the practical consequences of these victories will be from a policy standpoint. So, first, Mark, what will this wave of Republicans coming into the House mean for the lives of everybody here or the lives of everybody out there from a policy standpoint?
Well, what it's going to the real implications are going to be for what it's not going to mean. I mean, there's going to be no progress on immigration. There'll be no cap and trade.
Well, you don't think that there's a possibility that the House will try to do something on immigration and run up, because it wasn't as if immigration was a huge success story for the Democrats over the last years. It can't be less progress. There was no progress.
Well, and I don't think there's going to be progress in the next 2 years
right.
on that issue. I think that this is my view is that President Obama is a, you know, he understands the politics of the situation, and And I think, by the way, that the outcome of last night, while a very tough night for Democrats, and there's good news politically for President Obama as he looks at the Clinton model from 96, because now he's got shared responsibility for government and can point to the Republicans and say, okay, what are you guys doing? And so you can see those dynamics setting up. But, you know, they've got some, the Republicans will be putting into place some really significant substantive players like Paul Ryan. And he's got some great ideas, and if the president, and I think he will, I think he's going to make, you know, some hold out some olive branches and make some genuine overtures to try and work with the Republican leadership. And if they do the same thing, he knows that he's got to do some fiscally responsible and conservative things over the next couple of years. He understands that while he may have won a Democratic majority, that it is a conservative country. That even, you know, most a lot of Democrats consider them, 40% of the country considers themselves conservative, 22 liberal. Mike can break that down further, but the point is that, you know, a plurality, a strong plurality of the country considers themselves conservative. So he's not going to lose the left. There's going to be this dynamic on the left in the Democratic Party. The left's going to say that he lost because they didn't do, you know, they didn't go far left enough. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, the way that he'll win re-election is by doing what Clinton did and tacking to the middle and doing some serious fiscal responsible things and fiscal legislation. So that's the way that I think that he's going
to
get some...
You think it's politically in his interest to do that. Is it politically in the Republicans' interest to move to the center to meet him halfway or part of the way?
Well, I don't know if move to the center is the right framing for it. I mean, they've got some good ideas, and they're the sort of ideas that will be good for them and good for Obama. And, you know, it's in Obama's best interest to try and pick off the independents and get independents back in a good place. And the way he's going to do that is by doing something on the fiscal side of the scale.
Mike, what do you think the consequences of the outcome of this election are going to be from a policy standpoint for Texas?
I think you're going to see that some of these ideas come to the forefront that may have been buried before. You know, we have people like Kevin Brady who took ideas like the sunset process that we have in Texas. And he's been trying every Congress to get that bill passed. There may be a better chance to get that attention on that type of bill. But let's actually put up every program and agency and a department and make it justify its existence or eliminate it. Because everything is going to center around the budget. It's going to start with the fiscal issues. Before you start talking about immigration reform or anything else, it's going to start with the budget.
So the shortfall is going to be job number one. And what will, let's talk specifically about that. What's that going to mean? What will the outcome of last night mean for the shortfall discussion in Texas? The fact that it's plus 22, the fact that the statewides did such a huge sweep, not small victories, but large victories. What does that tell you about what's going to happen on the...
I think you have more people now in the House. Of course, the Senate, we're not looking any different there. But in the House, you have more people that have the mindset of Governor Perry and Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst and even Strauss about, we're going to get our fiscal house in order. We've done this before. We've had deficits. We're going to do everything we can with the rainy day funds that we have available. We're going to look at each program. We're going to cut our budgets. And we're going to get through this. And you just have more support, I think, for that same philosophy or that same belief now.
Before we open up for questions, we have just a couple more minutes. Mark, you brought up 2012, and of course the obvious question is Rick Perry going to run for president?
Well, he ought to. I mean, when you look at the story that he's got to tell and the constituency and the base support that he has in the Republican Party, you know, I think the only surprise to me really has been that he hasn't been on the list earlier.
Well, yeah, but we've talked about this before. He has been on some list before.
Yeah, he's been on mine. Yeah. But
although you wrote a story for the Daily Beast about 2 weeks ago in which you had the top 10 people, and Rick Perry was not on the list of the top 10 candidates.
And what did I say when I wrote you back?
Yeah. Well, what did you say?
I fucked up.
It's okay. Well,
I wrote in 5 minutes.
We'll edit that. We'll edit that for Abilene. That's fine, actually.
But I put him on the list months and months ago, and I think that I think the buzz is going to start immediately. People are going to look at this race, and it's going to be to his advantage that everybody thought this was a close race, and then he blew it open. The Texas success story, and you look at what happened with jobs and the economy here, which is what really people are focused about, you know, whether he wants to or not, there's going to be a huge draft Perry movement.
So as you look at the rest of the potential field for 2012, you see him fitting in there in a way that would give him reason to run and Republicans a reason to want him to run.
Yeah, I think you kind of tick off the list, and it just, you know, governor of large state, you know, did a great job in the economy when other states were having a really tough time. You know, real model success story. Very popular among base, popular among the Tea Party. You know, so as you, I think there's a very good chance a good draft and could run. Alternatively, you could get an establishment Republican like Romney nominated, and so a natural VP pick would be Perry.
Be a hell of a ticket from a hair standpoint, wouldn't it? I know we make a lot of that, but that would be some great ticket hair, actually.
Yeah.
As you look at Governor Perry from your perspective as his pollster and someone who's known him politically for a long time, do you look out 2 years and think this is a plausible thing? I mean, I know that the people around the governor have been kind of like, we're not really talking about this, and he's like, I'm not going to run, but you understand that's not going to stop all of us from talking about it.
You asked me the question 8 months ago this very day.
I did. Well, what'd you say then?
I said it was halftime of a game. We just got through the halftime. We got a third and fourth quarter to run. And as far as I know, we just got the nomination for governor.
Game's over.
Now we have a legislative session to deal with.
So it's like the middle of the third quarter? What is it now? The game
was over for the election, but right. Governing continues. So that's what we're going to do next.
So you don't have an opinion that you're willing to share on whether this?
Well, I think everybody agrees with what Mark said. If you look around, the country, and I think Republicans are going to be looking for somebody, particularly if you look at the Tea Party movement that's involved and the type of people that are attracted to what's not Obama, and that is somebody from outside of Washington. I think Matthew Dowd wrote about it in the National Journal a few weeks ago, and he says, I don't know if Perry's running. I don't know if he's running, and I've been working with him. But I do know that he's the type of individual that has been able to show that you can do things with less government, not more, have the right policies in place to attract business. You know, when Perry decided to run again for this term, he had said something that I had never heard all in one sentence, and that was, I'm running again because I believe we have the transportation and the energy and the water, the infrastructure that we've been able to build and continue to build. We can attract the jobs into the state to provide the revenues we need for healthcare and education, everything else. He had it figured out. And this is what really fuels Rick Perry. What he wants to do with that beyond the next 5 months, I don't know. But right now, people have to look at him, and there's going to be a lot of talk about it. We can't stop the talk. You know, Dave Carney and Rob Johnson and everybody else done a great job getting us to this point. And we'll just work the session, and thank goodness we have a 5-month session, because I think that's about all we need.
I think the other thing that the Republican insiders will look at is
maybe the feds will pick up on that. Maybe less time in Congress will be
five months.
They'll look at the Texas story, but the other thing they'll look at is that Rick Perry has an amazing campaign record. I mean, this guy has been in some very tough battles, and he's been a very tough, disciplined campaigner. This guy knows how to win.
Can Sarah Palin get elected president?
She can get the nomination. She can't.
Can she get elected?
No.
Can she get elected president?
I think it's very difficult. It just depends. If you had the type of, if she was the nominee and last night for president, and we had the same attitude and anger at the Obama administration, the federal government, maybe. But I think you just got to watch her fave unfave as time goes on, and she's to many people a very polarizing figure, very attractive to the conservative Republicans. But very polarizing on a general election sense.
Okay. All right, well, let's stop here, this portion of it. Let's give our guests, Mark McKinnon and Mike Basiles, a hand for their time and their insights. And now let's do as much in the way of questions from all of you as we can, because I'm sure you've got good ones to ask. Sir?
Numerically, how big is the Tea Party?
Well, that's a good question. I've asked questions such as we do with the image of the two parties, the Democrat and Republican Party. And you mentioned it earlier, how 53% of Americans have an unfavorable opinion of both the Democrat Party and the Republican parties. In Texas, it's the other way around. The Republicans are 53% positive, 40 negative, but the Democrats here are just like they are nationwide. The Tea Party movement in Texas, I can tell you, is about 45 positive viewpoint and a 32 negative or unfavorable. I asked a different question in the last week of the campaign, because I thought, let me ask this, and I'll be able to share more with this when I dig into the crosstabs more for a talk I'll be giving here, I guess, in about 10 days, 9 days. And 14% of Texas voters share all the views of the Tea Party movement.
All.
21% share most, 27% share some, 29% none, 9% run short.
Did you ask how many people at any point self-identify as part of the Tea Party movement?
No, that's another question. And so everybody's asking questions different ways to try and get a handle on how big is this movement, how deep does it go, and I'm interested in how do they vote. And the people that share all the views of the Tea Party movement are voting very Republican. Even the people that share some of the views of the Tea Party movement are a little bit more Republican than they are Democrat. It's just the people that share none of the views of the Tea Party movement that lean very, very Democrat.
Okay. Other questions? Just take your hands up. We'll get you. Sir?
Yeah. Y'all talked a little bit about the media earlier, kind of jokingly about the Dallas Morning News. But did y'all poll on that? You know, would Perry not debate, would not go to, you know, the editorial boards? Was that a strategy? Did you ever poll on that, or was that just some gut?
Well, let me ask you about that. There was a, we heard, all of us in the press heard that there was a poll that you all took or that you were aware of in Houston during the primary where you asked, if the Houston Chronicle endorsed a candidate for governor, would it make you more likely or less likely to support him? And less likely was 2-1 over more likely.
We did that all around the state.
You did.
And in the Houston media market, we plugged in the Houston Chronicle. And
you plugged in various papers.
When we got into the rural areas, we just said the paper you read most often. And in the Republican primary, we didn't do this in a general election, but in the Republican primary, it was, I think, a little bit over 2-1 were less likely to vote for the candidate that got the endorsement of their paper. We didn't do anything like that in the general election.
So you lost every endorsement in the primary. You lost all but Waco and Midland, and even Midland was kind of a half-hearted endorsement, and it didn't make a difference.
Inverse correlation.
Did not make a difference. I'm sure the newspaper publishers are thrilled to hear that. Mr. Shields.
I know this wasn't going to be concentrating on legislative stuff, but it's fascinating to me that what you did cover, the word speaker's race never was uttered. With 99 Republicans in the House, which is pretty close to 100, is there a speaker's race?
Well, and in fact, Mr. Strauss lost 17 Democrats who supported him last time. But, and yet, I mean, do you believe this 122 pledges that the speaker released last time?
I don't think you'd release it if you didn't have it.
But that doesn't mean that it wouldn't be the first time that happened.
Right. But that doesn't mean there won't be a speaker's race.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
You think there will not even be a race?
I'm not saying there won't or there will be. I think there still could be. I don't know. I haven't heard from Mr. Chisholm yet. Representative Chisholm may still want to do it. I don't know. And other people may throw their name out.
Well, the conventional wisdom-ish was that if there are many more Republicans elected than had been predicted, that was actually worse for Strauss. But Strauss seems to be saying it's actually better for Strauss.
I think it's pretty significant that he showed 122 pledges. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's in the party's best interest that he remain speaker.
Including a bunch of the people who were elected last night.
Yeah.
You know, people who didn't even expect to get elected last night.
Yeah.
Other questions for these guys? Ask them while you got them.
Is Jack McDonald the smartest candidate out there?
Not to have pulled out against McCall?
Yeah. He got a million something.
I guess the implication of that is this was a year not to run, huh? If you're a Democrat.
You might also be a little bit wealthier.
As a consequence of not running?
Of not running.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Ms. McCann.
I think so.
I wonder for anybody, for all of you, what you think the influence, if any, will be of American Crossroads GPS. As they're just gearing up now, you've seen the impact of the money in this election. And then also, my perception is that FreedomWorks and Americans for Progress have really done a lot to underpin the Tea Party efforts. And so I'm just wondering if you think that they are going to have greater influence, what their influence would be going forward.
These are these outside groups that have been criticized by some for not revealing, in every case, the source of the money that they're then spreading around.
Carl Rove has, raised how many, $75 million, already, so.
Yeah, what about that, and how consequential were these guys in this race?
I think consequential. I think that some very smart people put together a very smart strategy, raised a lot of money, and had a lot of impact on important races. And I think that they will take those successes and look to the future and make sure that they maximize the advantages that are available to them under the law. And I think it was very smart. I think what they did was very smart. But I think there's also a lot of mythology about the big money spending and where it's coming from. The greatest single spender on this election was a union. AFSCME spent $87 million. One union. So you stack it.
But did so publicly. Right, I mean, we know that they did it.
Well, we know that they spent $87 million.
Right.
And we know how much everybody else spent, too.
Right. Yeah.
So
I think in Charlotte's question was at least I'm going to interpret some question about, well, is there anything wrong with, nothing wrong with group spending money, but is there anything wrong with group spending money where the origin of the funds is?
Well, I have a very strong personal viewpoint on this. I think every cent should be disclosed. I think it should be entirely transparent. I am I was disappointed by the Supreme Court ruling. I'm for significant campaign finance reform. That's one of the reasons I initially was attracted to John McCain. And I think we need radical campaign finance reform, but that's not what the Supreme Court has ruled. It's going to be a long time before anything changes. So, we see this in every election, that the Democrats and the Republicans, they'll figure out a way to maximize their advantages under the system that they've got. And the past two elections, Democrats have done that because Democrats had the energy and had the tide, and they raised more money than Republicans. And in fact, in the overall net fundraising in this election, I'm not sure the Republicans even outraised Democrats. But anyway, but to your point, the organization Crossroads, they did an effective job. They spent their money well. They raised a lot of money, and they're going to continue to do it.
Well, if you think about it, in Texas, they put money into the Flores-Edwards race. Flores won. They put money into the Rodriguez.
Yeah, I haven't broken it down, but I bet when you go down the list,
the win-loss record is probably pretty good.
Yeah.
You agree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I think Mark said it. Organizations will do what they can, and under the legal structure we have and whatever the various Supreme Court rulings are, and they'll take every advantage of what they
can
do.
Listen, there's sort of an unwritten thing here and often unsaid, but I'll just say it. I think there was a lot of lack of confidence in the Republican National Committee. And that they felt that they needed to go outside to do it.
So you don't support Michael Steele as chairman for a second spin?
I'm not saying
spin?
That. I'm just saying that I think some people looked at that operation, saw that there were some problems, said we better do an end run here.
But I think the interesting thing about Steele is Steele's been criticized so much, but the old rule is when you win, you're a genius. When you lose, you're an idiot. His side, his party, won significantly at the time that he was chair of the Republican National Committee. Why shouldn't he go around crowing for a while? Why shouldn't he demand to be reelected?
Well, he can crow, and he can ask to be reelected, but there's more groups out there than there ever were before. Look at Texas. I mean, there was a day when the Associated Republicans of Texas was the only group, and it was a group that was formed outside the Republican Party of Texas.
Right.
And Norm Newton's group would go out and raise money from business guys. Now there's, I don't know how many groups there are. There's a lot of different groups that are...
By the way, the reason that the system bothers me so much, I mean, the main reason, is that you look around now at the system that we've got, and basically what you have happening in a lot of races, I think the Colorado Senate race would be a good example, but you could look at the Arkansas primary, a lot of other ones, where the outside money being spent on those races, and let's just say, take two examples, the unions on one side, the Chamber of Commerce on the other, are outspending the actual campaigns themselves by 3, 4, 5 to 1. So the races are really not between the candidates, it's between these outside interests, and I think that's a problem.
Mr. Richards.
I've been seeing some questions raised lately about the effectiveness of all this money being spent mainly on TV advertising. A Freakonomics author, I forget which one it was, said the other day that if you double your campaign's advertising, spending on advertising, it may raise the vote by 1%. You cut it in half and you lose 1%. What do you think of that sort of argument?
That's kind of your business.
Sure. I think most money spent on television political advertising is wasted. I say that generally, but especially in presidential elections. The voters are pretty sophisticated, and they're very cynical about politics, generally speaking. But they're incredibly cynical about political advertising. They just assume that whatever they see, that somebody's lying to them. And that's why it's a really difficult job for the people who make the ads to try and do something effective. And I when I did the first presidential race, I went back and studied all the presidential campaigns and their advertising. And it's interesting to watch over time. There's a real evolution of political advertising and what works and what doesn't. And what happens is that the market, which is voters, gets immunized or inoculated about what they see. And so every cycle, it kind of gets different, or you could say worse. You know, they have to be more dramatic, more sort of out there. And I think we saw a lot of that this election. But, you know, I really do believe that we've gotten to a point where voters just tune out almost everything that they see and hear. Now, you know, it's still, when you're playing around the margins and you're trying to figure out, you know, how you're going to get to 50.1 and you've got resources, what's the best use of your resources? I mean, still a lot of that money's being directed that way, but, you know, in the last presidential election, I was saying, shit, take 75% of that money and put it somewhere else. Because, you know, it's useful as part of trying to create a narrative, but in terms of really persuading voters who are actually seeing the advertising, increasingly minimal return on investment.
Mike, I'm thinking about people, some people in this room know this ad I'm talking about. I'm thinking about the ad that Mark Homer put up against Irwin Cain at the very last minute. That was it seemed to be at least a devastating ad that accused Irwin Cain of unspeakable things, and Homer still got killed by Cain by double digits.
Doesn't necessarily
make a difference.
We almost thought this was the way it came out. Is this sort of like Johnson's ad with the girl pulling on the petals off the flower, the Daisy ad? It was out there, but it really wasn't out there that much. There was more radio out there than there was being seen on the TV ad. And they floated it. I thought they might get more press. I don't know what their strategy was, because the TV ad itself didn't play nearly as much as Irwin Cain's response to it. And if anything, we were able to call him the Mark Homer campaign despicable, negative campaign.
You had Cain's business.
We had
this race. Yeah.
And so we got on that right away. We had several different responses, and we were more dominant in our response than I think their attack.
Voters are really suspicious of anything that breaks late in a campaign like that. I mean, they're just going to assume that if they haven't heard about it
happens
before,
in the last week.
It just happened in the last week or two. They're going to be wait a minute. Why didn't I hear about this before?
Yeah. Now the Perry campaign, in particular, in this cycle, spent its money non-traditionally in terms of how they marketed the governor to people. They didn't go the usual route. They used a lot of social media, a lot of new tools, didn't do yard signs.
We did the same thing in the primary. One thing that Dave Carney, you got to give him credit, he likes to do things that work and stick with them, and if they're not working, move to something else. And we did some tests a few years ago, and we found out that there's nothing like television. It trumps direct mail, newspaper ads, radio, there's nothing like television. And you talk about how you run a certain amount of television, you can increase your vote 1%. There's not enough study, as far as I'm concerned, that goes on after the elections to find out, for this amount of money spent, you know, okay, what would have happened? You know, if we lowered it, what would have happened? What happened in similar races? Problem is, we don't have dual universes for every campaign to see what would have happened if we would have pulled back. Perry's kind of rewritten the rules on how to campaign. No yard signs, no direct mail, social marketing, and a lot of television. So television still works.
Yeah.
But and I can say, just looking at the data that we were tracking, once we got up to about 1,000 points a week mark, we were increasing our lead about a point a week.
It just has an effect.
So, yeah, television is still, despite its diminishing return, far more effective than any other way of communicating with people.
Let's take one or two more.
I'm going to do the next election. I'm going to come up with the new thing. You know what it is?
What's that?
Negative yard signs.
Yeah.
Negative yard signs. That sounds like a challenge. It'd be fun to write those, wouldn't it, actually? So let's do one or two more before we go here. Anybody else? In the back, yes, sir.
You see any party spot motions? Sometimes that happens.
Oh yeah, that's good. So who's the next Chuck Hobson? Who's the next Chuck Hobson?
In the state house, we took on the Republican side so many seats.
There are WD-40s. There's WD-40, I think, right? There's Alan Ritter. Who else is there?
I'm looking down here. The first 90 seats in terms of the Republican Orbis, they're all. Every one of them is now gone. And you go 91, 92. I mean, there aren't many. I would have to look closely at this. And I guess if you are an incumbent Democrat, you're looking very closely at redistricting and wondering, let me see what comes out in the next few months before I make that decision.
Well, in fact, we looked at the Texas Weekly Partisanship Index last night to see, you know, where it kind of crosses into the Democrats. And apparently the most centrist Democrat, according to that index now, who survived last night is Donna Howard. I mean, you know, there aren't a whole lot of... By 15 votes, and presumably there's going to be some kind of a recount in that race, right? She won by 15 votes. Wow. I mean, the thing is, there aren't a whole lot of Democrats to switch who set up as obvious targets as Hobson did, right? They've either been defeated or they've already switched. All right, well, let's call it here. We are very fortunate. You know, there's going to be a week of debriefs. You're going to see some of these guys, some of us guys on things. You're going to be sick of us by the end of the week, but we had the first one. It was wonderful. Let's give these guys a hand. Mike Vasilis and Mark McKinnon. Thank you all for coming. Please become members of the Texas Tribune. Thank you.
Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, IBC Bank, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.